From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
My husband and I called our accountant to see if I never worked again, if, you know, we'd be able to put the kids through college.
Literally.
It was scary.
You literally did that.
I literally did that.
When David Letterman admitted in 2009 to sleeping with female staffers, something inside TV writer Nell Scovell snapped. She wanted to speak out about how those relationships had affected her when she worked for Letterman years earlier, but she feared retaliation. Scovell, who has worked on TV shows from Newhart to NCIS to Sabrina the Teenage Witch, explains why she decided to take the risk of writing in Vanity Fair about her experience working for Letterman. And she tells us about her new book, Just the Funny Parts. But first on the News Banter, broadcast networks are cheering for Roseanne. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my leadoff batter in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. Happy baseball season.
Yeah, happy baseball season. Dodger fan, you are a big one.
Yes, I am.
You're going to be having fun, I hope, again. So, Roseanne, the broadcast networks, even the ones that aren't ABC, which benefited from this gigantic performance, 18 million people tuned in to watch the rebooted Roseanne. I should call it the reconstituted Roseanne, since really it's kind of the same Roseanne with the same cast and some fast forwarding. That is such a huge number, and the broadcast networks are so happy to be able to once again make the point. And they are losing, you know, advertising money, according to the recent trends, a lot. But they are happy to make the point that broadcast networks are the big tent. They are the only ones who command that kind of audience. Certainly no cable channel comes near it, and we don't know about streaming, but we suspect not. So I'm sure people were just thrilled, even if they were CBS or NBC.
Yeah, I mean, Channing Dungey, the head of ABC, did an interview with Hollywood Reporter in which she said it's a great day for all of broadcast. And I do believe that's true, because that is the narrative heading into the upfront that they all want to push, is that, yeah, there's a ton of content out there, but if you really want to make an impact and get that big tent, you've got to go to broadcast television. And we've seen with some of these reboots this year, with Will and Grace doing very well on NBC, X-Files sort of doing okay on Fox, they are able to get this big interest and tune in for these nostalgia-oriented shows.
And of course, people are analyzing like crazy. Several have done well, but this is much more than well. Of course, it overperformed in Middle America in places like Tulsa, Kansas City. But before people draw simplistic conclusions, you know, it didn't do that well in a place like Salt Lake City. It was among the bottom-ranked markets, or Greensboro, North Carolina, or Jacksonville, Florida. So people, I think, should analyze carefully. One of the factors here is that Roseanne is now a Trump supporter. I think that contributed to the tune-in. There was curiosity as to how that would play, as well as nostalgia for the family and the couch and the Afghan and the whole deal. You're trying to walk a line in this show. You know, she is a Trump supporter, but also, you know, they have a gender fluid grandson, and they're dealing with issues like that. That is the line that they will walk. It remains to be seen going forward whether the interest remains that high.
I do think with all this content out there in the universe right now, there is a feeling in the zeitgeist. People are longing for that shared experience of something that we all talk about and watch. And those don't really exist on TV anymore outside of the big sporting events and maybe some of the reality shows. And this is that. Everyone came in our office on Wednesday morning and said, okay, what did everyone think of Roseanne last night? And there's a touch point for everyone. I think that's part of the appeal. And obviously the politics played a role because, you know, President Trump congratulated Roseanne on her ratings and all of his supporters see that. And I think there's going to be a momentum behind this show because of it.
Yeah, if you like Trump, go watch Roseanne. I think Roseanne herself, it's a little bit of a dicey thing because she has pretty extreme views. She's pretty out there. You know, she has apparently tweeted and then deleted something about David Hogg, the activist from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, very public face of that, and compared him with a Nazi, I'm reading on Twitter. And then people assumed that ABC had asked her to delete that tweet. And you have to take everything on Twitter with a big grain of salt. I haven't specifically called ABC and asked about this myself. But it seems that aside, she just has very, in some cases, odd views. And if she gets too out there with that, I think it could become a problem.
Yeah, when we spoke with the head of ABC, she wasn't even aware of the Nazi tweet. And I think their position is they want this to be seen as a big, broad comedy that everyone can get behind. I think internally, they are probably now going to try to stoke some of that interest in Middle America. And, you know, maybe they did some marketing stunts with NASCAR and other things. But I think this is a wake-up call for a lot of the television business right now. And, you know, how can we capture some of that audience?
Yeah, I mean, I will say the second and third episodes, which I've seen already, are much less Trump content and much more onto the business of Roseanne as the family dealing with challenges. Speaking of challenges, Ryan Seacrest, you know, this woman who was his stylist for several years, she accused him of misconduct that sort of did not land in terms of, you know, he wasn't suddenly dropped from his show with Kelly Ripa or from the red carpet on E! For the Oscars or American Idol. You know, these networks have a lot riding on Ryan Seacrest. They basically said they'd investigated and found nothing. She's just written a piece saying she filed a police report. She published that in The Hollywood Reporter saying, I filed a police report because I'm not going away. And Ryan Seacrest is saying, I didn't do it. I don't know that the police report will get it there, but I think this may be one that lingers. And I find that people in power, you know, accused people in power still can fend these charges off much more easily, perhaps, than people who are descending in their career, as Harvey Weinstein was when he was attacked by women, finally, who he had attacked.
Yeah, this is an interesting case because it represents what I think is going to be the next front in a lot of these Me Too cases and cases of alleged harassment, in that NBC Universal did an investigation. They followed up and did what they are calling a thorough investigation and found the claims inconclusive and there was not enough evidence to do anything about it. Now you have this accuser not only going public with her claims and saying, no, this did actually happen, but she's questioning the manner in which the investigation was undertaken. She's saying that her witnesses that she provided were not interviewed, including her therapist and her boyfriend at the time, both of whom were very familiar with the claims. NBC, in response, is saying, well, we are only interviewing direct witnesses of the interactions between Seacrest and the stylist. They're not going to people who may have heard secondhand about this. But it gets to this question of what is a thorough investigation and what is enough when you're going to exonerate someone who's been accused.
Yeah, I find that pretty limited. And I'll just point out that, you know, I covered the Roy Price story at Amazon. They investigated him twice. They may or may not have taken measures, but nothing happened with respect to his employment until one of the accusers finally went fully on the record. And then he was gone very quickly. So sometimes these investigations, you know, may or may not be what they should be. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. If you've ever watched Newhart, Coach, Murphy Brown, or even NCIS, you've likely seen the work of Nell Scovell. Scovell got her start at Spy magazine, but moved into writing for television. She racked up many credits since the late 1980s, including a short but memorable stint on Late Night with David Letterman, where she was only the second woman ever hired to work on the show. That's just one of the reasons for the full title of her new book, Just the Funny Parts, and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. Scovell created the 1996 ABC series Sabrina the Teenage Witch. It starred Melissa Joan Hart as Sabrina, who thinks she's a normal teenager until she turns 16 and learns she has special powers. She lives with her two wacky aunts, also witches, and a talking cat named Salem, voiced by Nick Bakay. The show follows Sabrina as she works to balance her unusual home life with typical teenage drama, like when she attempts to have a private phone call with her high school crush.
Salem, are you spying on me?
I'm a cat. I'm curious. So kill me.
Out!
Fine. I understand the delicacy of the moment. Harvey and Sabrina, Harvey and Sabrina.
Scovell went to work on Just the Funny Parts before the Me Too and Time's Up movements exploded, but now it's hard to view her decidedly feminist book through any other lens. Can I say that you have sexual harassment talk fatigue?
Sure.
Is that fair to say? I mean, you are trying to walk this line and you're telling your story. And part of it is, this is my story and women are not represented and treated fairly in the industry. But that is inextricably interwoven with sexual harassment. So now we're stuck in a little bit of a place here, right? I mean,
right. It's also, when I started in the late 80s, I just wanted to be treated like the guys.
Right.
And I dressed
like
a guy. Yes. And I love sports. I love science fiction. I was a good culture fit. And, you know, I was always a feminist, but at the same time, it's strange to only see my career through that prism of gender.
Your career it's so diverse in terms of stuff you've worked on, because you go from Gary Shandling early on, and then you've got NCIS in there, and you've got The Simpsons, and I can't quite figure out how NCIS gets in the middle of that.
Mystery. I went through a period where I wrote for Monk and NCIS, and I was a bit of a challenge junkie. So where other people would have said, what am I doing on NCIS? I just dug in and tried to figure it out.
So, but going to this theme of this disparity, certainly in Late Night, you were on Late Night with David Letterman, and we'll talk about that a bit. But all the way through, women are not represented, it seems.
No, not at all. And that show had started with a female head writer, the great Meryl Marco.
The David Letterman show, yeah.
Who was dating Dave. And one of my frustrations, and Meryl is a really good friend, and I've talked about it with her, was she never hired other women. So that show got off to the start with just the one female, and she was the most powerful person in the room, but then she leaves after 6 seasons, and they don't have another woman for 2 more years when I get hired. And when I was hired, I'd already worked on 5 shows. I had worked on the final season of Newhart. I'd written for The Simpsons. I'd sold a script to It's Gary Shandling's show. And what's interesting is they've done studies where men get promoted based on potential and women on experience. So a lot of the men at Letterman, they did stand-up. They came from Spy magazine.
Yeah, Harvard, Lampoon.
Right. And I'd come out of Spy, but then had to work for all these TV shows before I could get my shot at Letterman. But it was such a funny show, and it really was my dream job. I mean, I still remember walking to 30 Rock that first day and just being filled with happiness.
And so you walk into this environment where it's guys.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said something very weird to you on your way in that I still am puzzling over. By the time we're done here,
I will see a tampon fall out of your purse.
Like, who says that? I don't get that.
I puzzled over it for years, and I give a theory in the book about why he said that, which is, I think it was something called stereotype threat, which is he wanted to remind me of my gender, in part because there's that perception that women aren't funny, and I think it was supposed to throw me off my game.
Wow, and I wonder if it was even conscious or that's...
No,
you
I'm
don't
sure
think
it
so.
Wasn't. I don't. But, you know, if you just want to make a joke about a bodily function, you could say, before this is over, I will hear you fart.
Yes,
right?
I think that would be a better joke, actually, yeah.
So it was pointed, and my last day on the show, a tampon fell out of my pocket in front of him. It was such a bizarre moment.
Were you unconsciously seeding the ground with
maybe.
A tampon?
No, but maybe it was like the bringing it all full circle.
And this business within Letterman.
Yeah.
So basically what happened is when you...
Dave goes on the air and admits, I have had sex with women I've worked with.
Right. And then you are no longer working for him at that point, but you've had this experience of being there.
Right.
And you decide, I think very courageously, to do a piece for Vanity Fair. You knew Graydon Carter from your days writing for Spy. And to write about your reaction to this acknowledgement that this stuff was going on, which I don't was hardly a secret in the world of David Letterman.
It was no surprise to anyone who had worked there.
Right. So you wrote in that piece, this is not from the book, but from this Vanity Fair piece.
Without naming names or digging up decades-old dirt, let's address the pertinent questions. Did Dave hit on me? No. Did he pay me enough extra attention that it was noted by another writer? Yes. Was I aware of rumors that Dave was having sexual relationships with female staffers? Yes. Was I aware that other high-level male employees were having sexual relationships with female staffers? Yes. Did these female staffers have access to information and willpower disproportionate to their job titles? Yes. Did that create a hostile work environment? Yes. Did I believe these female staffers were benefiting professionally from their personal relationships? Yes. Did that make me feel demeaned? Completely. Did I say anything at the time? Sadly, no.
Well, sadly, no. That would have been a big ask of yourself at that point in life, right?
I considered it. Because Dave pulled me into his office and he asked me why I was leaving so soon after arriving. I mean, they had picked up my option and any other writer would have been settling in. But I just told him I missed L.A.
Right.
You know, there were issues creatively, too, which is I had been part of scripted television and had written whole episodes. So when you go back on these shows and you're lucky if you get two jokes in on a night, it wasn't as much fun for me.
Right. You did do some of the top tens and all of that stuff. I mean, it's not like he didn't use your stuff, but you're...
Oh, he used a lot of it. Yeah.
But still, I mean, it's interesting because this reveals, this episode, that without, you don't have to be harassed yourself to be in a hostile work environment, which is supposedly not okay. And yet, I don't even think to this day, people really understand that, right?
Well, at the time, we had no vocabulary. You know, I thought the technical term was, it's f***ed up. It was pre-Anita Hill. I don't even know that I was aware of the term sexual harassment and certainly wasn't aware of the term sexual favoritism, which is a subset, and that's what it's called when you're not the target of the actual harassment, but because of the atmosphere, it can affect you.
When you did this Vanity Fair piece that we just talked about, did you sort of go, this could be bad for my career?
Oh, I didn't just sort of go. My husband and I called our accountant to see if I never worked again, if, you know, we'd be able to put the kids through college.
Literally.
It was scary.
You literally did that.
I literally did that. And I was nervous and scared. And, you know, Letterman was a huge star, and he made a lot of money for CBS, and I thought there could be retaliation.
Of course.
But this being Hollywood and the way people are with bylines, a few weeks later I was in a meeting and someone brought up the article and clearly had no idea that I had written it. And I was like, yeah, I think I read that.
Would they say that was amazing courage, or what did they say? Some crazy woman. No, more like the crazy woman wrote a thing.
I think the question was like, what was going to happen to Hollywood? You know, the hope was there'd be some investigation, but nothing.
I mean, he did play it very smart from a PR point of view, which was to come out and say, this happened, I did it, I'm sorry. And sometimes the apology and the acknowledgement is tremendously powerful in taking the energy out of a story, I find, as a reporter.
Yeah, well, it was a strange story. Remember, he was getting blackmailed.
Right.
So he was a victim, and, you know, you have to be sympathetic to that. I still am shocked that neither CBS or, I'll be frank, I asked the Writers Guild to step in and make some inquiries, and John Wells was running the Guild at the time. And
he's the showrunner of ER, famously, of
course,
among other things.
That went nowhere. Nobody wanted to take responsibility for investigating, and I think he got a pass for the underlying activity.
You think it would be like that now?
He's got a new Netflix show, and it's got 5 EPs, and they're all male.
Coming up after a short break, Nell Scovell talks about writing a famous early Simpsons episode and still not getting hired by the show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer Nell Scovell about her new book, Just the Funny Parts, which recounts her time working on myriad TV shows, including Newhart, Coach, Murphy Brown, and Monk. In most cases, she was the only woman in the writer's room. Early in her career, Scovell submitted a script for what was then a new animated show on Fox. You wrote a very iconic episode of The Simpsons, right?
Homer eats blowfish and thinks he's going to
die. He's going to die, yes.
Poison fish, poison fish, poison fish, tasty fish.
Ooh, it's good news, isn't it?
No, Mr. Simpson. No. If, in fact, you've consumed the venom of the blowfish, and from what the chef has told me, it's quite probable, you have 24 hours to live.
24 hours?
Well, 22. I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long.
Did you just freelance that one? I'm not sure.
I did, and I would have loved to work on the show. My agent called Sam Simon, and Sam kept saying no and wouldn't give a reason. And later, someone told me, who worked on the show, that he was going through a bad breakup and didn't want women in the room. And
always a reason.
You know, I didn't hear that from him, but for 5 more seasons, for over 120 episodes, they did not have a female writer.
Which is amazing because there's obviously female characters in The Simpsons.
Yeah. You know? No, and it's not like, you know, sometimes they go, well, we tried a woman and it didn't work. I mean, I think I did us proud.
Right. You represented your gender well.
I did. But that made me very sad. One of the nice things, though, was when Al Jean and Mike Reiss peeled off to do The Critic, one of the first calls they made was offering me a job on that staff. But I had just taken a job on Murphy Brown the day before. But I still wrote a freelance episode for The Critic.
So you wanted to, like, direct, which seems to be a really hard thing for women to get to do. It's just enormously difficult. Talk about the broken doorbell and your solution, because I love that.
So there's this knee-jerk reaction that in this industry that there's a pipeline problem, that, you know, we'd love to hire female directors, but they're just not experienced enough and they're not in the pipeline. So we've got to train young women and get them into the pipeline. I don't buy into that bullshit. I think there's a broken doorbell problem, and there are plenty of women with experience who are capable, and people of color who are standing on the doorstop ringing the doorbell and no one's opening the door.
And the solution?
Instead of having less experienced directors shadow more experienced directors, let the less experienced directors actually direct and have the more experienced directors shadow them and whisper in their ears if they think they're making a bad decision.
Simple.
Why not? Because if you're worried about taking the risk, there's a safety net. And if someone, you know, gets too emotional and has to run off the set hysterical because they're on their period, then you have someone right there who could step in.
Oh, yes. That would be terrible because, you know,
because it happens so often.
It happens all the time. Yeah. They can't function.
You know, I always say that I've worked in rooms with men who will get notes they don't like and walk in and throw the script and scream obscenities. And I always think anger is an emotion too.
Right.
Like men are really emotional.
They're so emotional, yeah. Gavin Pallone was your agent.
Yes. My first agent.
Your first agent. And he was a bad boy, like one of the most aggressive. I mean, he acknowledges this is not a thing
yeah.
that he doesn't admit. I think we did a piece about him once. I did called like The Dark Prince of Hollywood. Did you know he was litigious and is to this day? He thinks litigation is good. He was a wild man. Did you know that when you he was your agent or did he show?
We were friends. We were both really young in our 20s. So look, I went with Gavin when he bought his first non-American car. That's how far back we go.
Yes. I mean, did you think, well, I've got this badass agent and he's going to protect me? Or it was just like random, I like him.
He had just become an agent.
He was a baby.
He was a baby agent. Okay. And right. And I do want to say that after Gavin, I signed with Abby Adams and she was the greatest agent I ever had. And it was so wonderful to have a female agent and someone who believed in me. And she's the one who put me up for the showrunner job on Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And I'm not sure a male agent would have done that.
Mm. I think you addressed this to some degree in the book that, you know, there's a point where someone said to you, I think, I'm afraid that things will change if we have a woman, like in the writer's room.
Oh, yeah. It's a very sad story. I was asked about going on staff at a show that I would have really liked to go on. And I was in my 40s and not getting that many offers. And after I said I would be interested, he started musing, I wonder how it will change things to have a woman in the room. And I thought, well, he doesn't really mean how will it change things. He means how will it change my behavior. And I think there's a perception that women sit in judgment, or you couldn't talk about, you know, the Sports Illustrated bathing suit issue if a woman was there. And that made me sad because, you know, I'm your colleague, not your wife.
Right. But I do feel that, you know, with all of the what's been happening with Me Too and Time's Up, that they are afraid that the boys' club, the frat house, cannot be a frat house, right? That's what they're afraid of. I mean, I've talked to people at one of the major studios. I talked to one person who was an assistant, hearing phone calls because assistants listen in, and top male executives were saying, you know, don't let so-and-so find out about this trip because we don't want her.
Yeah.
Because they're going off to have fun. You know, there's lots of hookers and blow kind of thing. And that, you know, that does create, it hampers them.
It's even more subtle. When I was working very recently on The Muppets, I was the only high-level female. And the other male co-EPs and EP would ditch me for lunch. They would go off to lunch and leave me alone and come back and say, you know, we were talking about casting over lunch and we think so-and-so would be good. So I finally went to the EP and I said, look, I don't want to hone in on your social life, but if you're talking about business at lunch, you know, I really should be there or it makes it harder for me to do my job. And, you know, he called me paranoid.
And that was recent.
That was recent.
That's very disheartening. So that's,
and I'm sure it's incredibly common. And that's a way, you know, you don't have to be going to Vegas. You're just going to the commissary.
Right, right. But one way or another, these are kind of like the golf course of Hollywood, you know, these trips, these lunches, whatever.
And again, if they were going off to talk about fantasy football, I wouldn't care. But
that's not what's happening.
That's not what's happening.
Deals are being made.
That's right.
Since that Muppets experience was recent, asking you, is there hope question feels hopeless, but I will ask you, is there hope?
I'm hopeful about a couple of things. I sense a real shift in women supporting other women. When I started, you know, Robin Schiff was wonderful to me. There were other women, but I think there was still a sense of there can be only one, and that created competition. And I think women are much smarter now, and they've realized that that doesn't help us, and that the more the merrier. So that gives me a lot of hope. And then the other thing that gives me hope is the inclusion rider and what Stacey Smith is doing, and that it moves you past lip service. Everyone wants a more diverse workplace, right?
At least hypothetically, everyone does.
Hypothetically. Mm-hmm. Publicly, everyone would say that's what they want. And this just sets goals and creates punishments if those goals aren't hit.
Nell Scovell is the author of Just the Funny Parts and A Few Hard Truths About Sneaking Into the Hollywood Boys Club. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.